The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Obviously, serious political issues under discussion at this conference. The issue from last night's meeting, racism and the police violence of the capitalist state, civil war across the Middle East and Africa, the life or death struggle of survival of hundreds of thousands of migrant refugees in Europe and elsewhere, massive economic inequality and exploitation. Why have a meeting on art? It's an obvious question to ask, but one maybe that's not so obvious as to go unasked at the beginning of this meeting. And the place, I think, the best place to begin by trying to get our bearings on this basic question. Can you hear me okay in the back?
No.
Best place to get our bearings on this question, I think, is Trotsky's Literature and Revolution. The book was written in 1922, 1923, when the new worker state was still struggling for survival after the Civil War of 1918, 1921. Struggling for survival against its internal enemies who wanted either a return to a czarist regime or a capitalist Russia, and against the efforts of the major capitalist powers to destroy the revolution. So why would Trotsky take time off all the other things he had to do to write a book about literature at this point? Trotsky's introduction begins by acknowledging the obvious priority of economic and social survival. The economic problem at present is the problem above all problems, he says. At the same time, a culture liberated from the brutal distortions of czarism was beginning to emerge in Russia, had already begun the process of emerging right through the revolutionary period. Culturally and artistically, as well as economically and politically, Russia was, as you all know, a country of striking contrasts and contradictions. Economically, on the one hand, it was a country still primarily agrarian. The majority of the people were peasants living off the land. At the same time, in certain concentrated areas, it was a country of advanced capitalist production with a concentration of all those circumstances that characterized that kind of activity. Culturally, a vast majority of people in Russia at this time were illiterate. They couldn't read and write. On the other hand, before the revolution and into the revolutionary period, Russia was a place of a very striking modernist, experimental, artistic activity. Movements like Futurism had already begun to emerge before the events leading up to the 1917 revolution. A great artist like Mayakovsky would come into the Bolshevik Revolution from, as Trotsky points out, the kind of bohemian world of futurist art production. So those kind of contradictions are sort of there from the outset. For Trotsky, questions related to artistic development and artistic freedom couldn't simply wait until economic and political matters were resolved. Trotsky recognizes that art arises and responds to fundamental human need. This need doesn't have the same kind of primacy as other kinds of needs, the need for food or housing or transportation or communication, but it is nonetheless a basic need. Debate about what art could mean or might come to mean in a revolutionary worker state couldn't simply be postponed until the questions of material survival were all sorted out. We're of course not in anything like that kind of revolutionary situation today, but still I think Trotsky's approach to the status of art in relation to economic and political struggle is still relevant in a very sharp way. Let me just pose one kind of question, one kind of situation here for you to think about that for me kind of captures this. There have been stories, I'm sure you've all seen it, about the survival of the extraordinary ruins of antiquity in Palmyra, the city, the ancient city in the central part of Syria that in the last few months has been taken over by the Islamic State. I think Trotsky's point of view about that kind of situation, or this kind of situation, would be that the survival of the ancient ruins of Palmyra are inseparable from the survival of the Syrian people, caught between the interests of global imperialism on the one hand and brutally reactionary jihadism on the other. The fate or future of art is an inextricable part of the fate and future of human society. The two can't really be separated or pried apart. So today, especially today, but not simply starting today, art, like oil, is a capitalist commodity. Its status as a capitalist commodity isn't, of course, identical to that of oil. In fact, art's status as a commodity has some very distinctive things about it, which I'll have something a bit more to say a little later. For now, what I want to explore is a claim that Adam Turrell made at the beginning of his review of Ben Davis's 2013 Haymarket book, 9.5 Theses on Art and Class. By the way, this is a book really worth reading if you're interested in doing what I'm not particularly going to do in the talk this morning, which is to explore really basic kind of fundamental theoretical questions about what is art, what counts as art in the first place, can any object or any event that comes our way be regarded as a work of art. I think Ben Davis's book goes into those kinds of questions and explores them from the perspective of relations between art and class at the moment in a really fascinating way. Anyway, what Adam Turrell said in reviewing this book, what he says at the beginning is, art is in crisis. It is riddled with its own contradictions. And so I want to just explore with you for a second some of the kinds of contradictions that are involved in the production and access and presentation that both Adam Turrell and Ben Davis have in mind when they talk about art in this way. Consider this, for example. Between 2009 and 2013, in the midst of the Great Recession, fine art auction prices increased by 100% in the United States, 100%. The biggest sales were in contemporary art, not in the sale of old masters' paintings, but in contemporary art. And the trend continues. During a single week this past May, more than $1 billion of art was sold at the big auction houses in New York and London. No wonder Joel Geyer, in his talk on the economy yesterday, he was talking about asset bubbles, and he referred to art as one of the sectors where these asset bubbles are occurring. So you've got that on the one side. On the other, you've got the situation where most people who think of themselves as artists in the United States can't make a living from their work. They have to get a second job or sometimes a third job to survive. Or a kind of somewhat different version of this same contradiction. Picasso's 1955 painting called Les Femmes d'Alger, The Women of Alger, was sold at Christie's on May the 11th for $179.4 million. This is the record for any artwork sold at auction ever. Around that same time, I saw, and maybe you saw, articles in the newspaper showing that funding for arts education in public schools in the United States had virtually disappeared. I mean, the large areas of the country, large areas of most major cities even, where public schools don't even offer art education courses or art courses anymore. Or just to try to designate a different kind of contrast or contradiction of this kind, high quality digital images of the great works of art in the world's major museums are widely available now online in free, high-quality electronic form. This is great that is the case. On the other hand, getting direct access to these works is not such a simple matter. At the Art Institute here in Chicago, the standard admission fee is $25 for adults. It's $19 if you're a student. And if you're a student here in Chicago, you can get in for $14, which is still, I think, for working class people, working class students, not an inconsiderable factor. At the Metropolitan Museum in New York, the suggested entry price is $25. You can pay less and feel like what? Some kind of second class citizen, or like you're furtively sneaking into the museum if you only give them $10? Or that particular strategy I find especially annoying, you know. Suggested price $25 if you're a proper person, you know. If you're a real citizen of the United States or city of New York, pay the full amount. Now I'm partly in naming institutions like this, I'm focusing on high art or fine art, but I think related contradictions characterize the sphere of popular culture in other ways. Music, video, film, that sort of thing. And the fundamental contradiction here, I think, to keep in mind, is that popular culture is big business on a global scale, with all the exploitation and all the kind of ideological influence and control that comes with that. Despite this, though, I think we have to acknowledge, popular music and drama and film and dance can provide cultural space where working class and minority perspectives find, in spite of all the thing that goes to the other side of the contradiction, can actually find expression, can find representation. Though the contradictions and crises of art now are especially pronounced, those contradictions and crises, I think, have characterized artistic culture from the beginnings of class society to different degrees and different levels. Walter Benjamin, the great German Jewish critic and philosopher, wrote shortly before he committed suicide trying to escape the Nazis in 1940. It's a famous sentence. I'm sure many of you have heard it. There's no document of culture that is not at the same time a document of barbarism. Part of what Benjamin means, I think, is that some cultural objects and events, some works of art, don't just reproduce existing class relations. They document the barbarism of class rule by resisting and challenging it. Yet even those works are subject to the pressures of the art industry and art market, whatever the intentions of artists themselves. The art industry has a way of neutralizing and normalizing politically dissenting or radical works, and that has to be borne in mind, even in recognizing the possibility of their existing. The fact that in popular culture is not so dominated by the capitalist marketplace that no kind of space for the articulation of those impulses can ever be found. So how exactly does art, fine art, high art, but also popular art, function in capitalist society? How does it work? Art becomes a commodity in the first place because people want it, feel they need it, and are willing to pay for it. But in addition to its strictly economic status, the value of art in modern society derives from what the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu called cultural capital. Now, this idea of cultural capital that I'm going to be developing a bit here, I think is very valuable. But there are some important theoretical questions, I think, that might come up around it. How exact is the correspondence between cultural capital and economic or financial capital with respect to the dynamic of the kinds of relationships that define economic capital in the first place? So art, Bourdieu argues, is a crucial marker of class distinction. Our opportunity to become knowledgeable about high art especially, our ability to be comfortable in art museums, in concert halls, in theaters, even at sites of monumental antiquity, depends in part on whether we come from families and neighborhoods or go to schools where such cultural knowledge and access is both cultivated and, to a certain degree, taken for granted. Part of Bourdieu's argument is to show how, for the capitalist ruling class, cultural capital actually works to disguise and idealize the raw forces of economic competition and exploitation on which capitalist society at base is founded. We are taught to believe that art exists in its own realm of ideal, timeless, universal value. Not that it is inevitably reflects, however indirectly, the underlying historical and political conflicts of social reality. So turning now to what I have to say in this talk about art and imperialism, I wanted to argue that this idea of cultural capital is important in understanding the location and transmission of international cultural power and control. Consider for a second the handout that, has everybody got one of these handouts? I think we've got any more here, but I hope there are enough to go around. I apologize for the poor quality of the photocopy. The image is a bit weirdly blurred, even in its full color version on the book. Anyway, look at this image for a second. It's a black and white photograph from a dust jacket of a book published in 2008 titled Who Owns Antiquity? Museums and the Battle Over Ancient Cultural Heritage. I first saw this book when I was coming out of an exhibition at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, where I live. An exhibition that was called Art and Empire, Treasures from Assyria in the British Museum. How all that ancient Assyrian art made its way to London in the first place was part of what is disturbing about this exhibition and also interesting and important about it. Now the exit, when you got through to the end of the exhibition, you were immediately directed into the Museum of Fine Arts bookshop. You know, it was a very tight connection. You couldn't avoid it. Speaking of art and capitalism, I mean, I've developed a keen interest kind of in the evolution of the museum bookshop over the last 50 years. I mean, they're palaces of capitalist entrepreneurship and duplication. It's extraordinary. I mean, the bookshop and the museum, you know, the Metropolitan Museum in the Met is vast, and they sell everything from rugs to $300 or $400 replicas of ancient Egyptian jewelry and stuff like that. So it's extraordinary. Well, what caught my eye when I was having to make my way through the bookshop after seeing this exhibition was the colored dust version of the dust jacket of this book, and I immediately picked it up because I recognized in the image on the front that these two figures with their Uzi machine guns were members of the Italian Carabinieri. In fact, members of the special section of the Italian Carabinieri, the state police, who are trained to guard art and art museums and art galleries. In Italy, they make a specialty of that kind of police work. But I also recognized that where these two members of the Carabinieri were standing was in the Iraq National Museum in Baghdad in the summer of 2003 on orders from the US-led coalition as it was once again busy invading the country and claiming to destroy its imaginary weapons of mass destruction. In the background in this photo are 9th century BC sculptural remains from the ancient Assyrian city of Nimrud, located about 20 miles south of Mosul, the northern Iraqi city, which, as you probably know, has been in the control of the Islamic State for about a year. The dust jacket photo seems to show the US-led coalition protecting Iraq's artistic heritage. In fact, the reality of this situation was quite different. The US provided no protection at all for the Baghdad Museum during the first few months of its onslaught. All of its military might, all of its resources were devoted to destroying the army of Saddam Hussein and to protecting oil refineries and oil pipelines. They only sent this contingent of soldiers, policemen, to the Baghdad Museum once it was too late, once a vast amount of looting had happened, extraordinary number of objects were taken away. Some of them have been brought back. The Baghdad Museum reopened 6 months ago, maybe 9 months ago, after being closed for a long time, but there's still a lot gone from what was there in the beginning. Now, knowing a little bit more about the author of Who Owns Antiquity may help us understand the connections between U.S. military and economic imperialism and what I'm calling cultural imperialism. James Kuno, this author, was trained as an art historian. He's got a PhD from Harvard. When this book was written and published, he was director of the Art Institute in Chicago. He was here from 2004 to 2011. Before then, from 1991 to 2002, he was director of the Harvard Art Museums, all of them. Since 2011, this is the best part, he was made and has been director of, he was made president and CEO, no more director of, now president and CEO of the J. Paul Getty Trust, whose museums in Los Angeles and Malibu contain some of the most valuable Egyptian, Greek, and Roman antiquities in the world. The Getty Museum was forced under international law to return a 3rd century BC bronze statue that they'd acquired under very sleazy terms 80 or 90 years ago. It had originally been looted and made its way onto the art market, and there's a procedure under international law. Now, I may have something more to say about this later. The way international law works in this regard is actually an interesting question. So that's James Kuno's current job. President and CEO. As for Getty, you probably know, he's the founder of the Getty Oil Company, and in 1957 was declared to be the richest living American. So these are the interconnections between antiquities, art, museum spaces, and the patterns of global imperialism that I'm trying to bring into view. Now, Kuno's book, Who Owns Antiquity, is a polemical attack against archaeologists who argue that ancient works of art should remain in the countries where they were made and found. Kuno, on the other hand, says he believes just the opposite to that, that these priceless remains of antiquity really belong in what he calls the great universal encyclopedic museums. Where they can be properly protected and studied and displayed. His argument is a version, actually, of the one made for 2 centuries now by the British government as to why the so-called Elgin marbles, the 5th century BC sculptures taken from the Parthenon in Athens and sold to the British state in the early 1800s, why these things should remain in London and not be returned to Athens, where a number of years ago, I've seen it, they built a beautiful new modern museum with all the facilities, all the climate-controlled things for taking fine care of the Parthenon remains. The British Museum actually loaned a significant piece from the Parthenon marbles earlier this year, but they didn't loan it to Greece. They loaned it to Russia. And the Greek government at the time had a thing or two to say about it. Alexis Tsipras actually said in January on British TV that Sears has strongly supported the ongoing cause of having the Parthenon sculptures returned to Greece. Of course, the great universal encyclopedic museums that Kuno likes to champion just happen to be located mainly in the centers of Western global economic and political power: New York, Washington, Chicago, London, Paris, Berlin, Los Angeles, Malibu. I mean, you have to add Malibu. Such accumulations of artistic and cultural capital in the center of Western imperialism is in no way coincidental. Washington, D.C., doesn't just need the Capitol, the White House, and the Pentagon. It also needs the National Gallery, which was founded in 1930 by Pittsburgh banker and billionaire and Treasury Secretary Andrew Mellon. In some respects, modern art imperialism echoes the ancient spoils of war tradition. The Roman Empire displayed vast collections of art taken when it conquered Greece and Egypt. Rome today is still full of ancient Egyptian obelisks that were somehow brought on board ships to Rome in the imperial period. And one of the things that I really find fascinating is the recycling of artistic monuments from one imperial moment to another. So if you include in these kinds of contexts the period of the Napoleonic Wars, which I'm going to go on and talk about for a second, and the period of Italian-German fascism, I mean, you find Egyptian monuments taken into and made part of Imperial Roman culture, then recycled by Napoleon and his project of making Rome the second capital of his empire, and then recycled and relocated and situated again by Mussolini when, in the 20s and 30s, this vast archaeological project of remaking Rome and restoring its imperial cultural aspect was a priority. Now, what happened during the Napoleonic era is particularly interesting in this connection. It's very especially interesting to me, and I hope it will be to you, because of its relation to European imperialism at the time of the bourgeois revolutions in the late 18th and early 19th centuries. France and Britain, as you probably know, competed fiercely for possession of ancient Middle Eastern art and antiquities as part of their larger rivalry for power in that part of the world. Britain was clearly the winner at the level of what we could call cultural property. The Rosetta Stone, the colossal bust of the statue of Pharaoh Ramses II, which is the historical original of Shelley's figure of Ozymandias in the famous poem. The Parthenon sculptures, remember that Greece was still part of the Ottoman Empire at the beginning of the 19th century. All of these things are in the British Museum. But Napoleon's influence at this historical moment was also really, and in an intense way, significant. He first rose to power through the success of the Italian campaigns, which he began in 1797 and extended through the annexation of Rome and the Papal States in 1809, 1814. That part of Italy was actually declared to be part of France during that period. Napoleon promised the Italians national unification and liberation from the domination of the Catholic Church and from the old aristocratic ruling class. What he actually gave the Italians was something different. He had himself crowned King of Italy in 1804, and his being crowned King of Italy really came as the kind of culmination of a period in which he expropriated a vast amount, an almost unimaginable amount, of Italian art, which he put on wagons and somehow got to and installed in Paris in 1798 and 1799 in a new museum, a newly invented, newly created museum that we now know as the Louvre. The Louvre was established, declared into existence in 1793, the year of the Jacobin dictatorship, the year when the monarchy was abolished. It was a very, very interesting moment, interesting convergence of historical facts. The king and queen of France lose their head, and the Louvre is brought into being at the same time. And the creation of the Louvre is really one of the most remarkable, certainly at the level of culture, I think, one of the most remarkable accomplishments of the French Revolution. Despite the revolutionary republican agenda that we're invited to think about here, however, underlying the accomplishment, the ideological justification for Napoleon's art confiscations is another matter. It has important features in common with Kuno's argument about the priority that needs to be given to the great universal encyclopedic museums. The Louvre, it was argued at the time by Napoleon and his people, would provide secure, scientifically organized displays and art masterpieces for anyone in the world who wanted to come to Paris and see them. At the same time, Napoleon proclaimed himself as the fount and origin of this great invention. And the Louvre would come to be seen as a cultural monument to the Napoleonic Empire. and to the values of the French Revolution, which Napoleon, by this time, had completely co-opted and distorted. By the way, during these years, the Louvre wasn't called the Louvre, it was called the Musée Napoléon, and it was for quite some time. When Napoleon fell in 1815, the British opportunistically oversaw the restoration of European political power to the old aristocratic princes and the Pope, and also the restoration of most expropriated artworks back to Italy and also to Germany and Holland and other countries where they'd been taken. Most, but not all. Some of the confiscated art was left behind in the Louvre to bolster the image of the new reactionary French king, who was, I wanted to completely humiliate him in an artistic sense, though they left a few fairly nice things from Italy in the Louvre so that the king, you know, Louis XVIII could take pride in it. Some of the initially confiscated art made its way into the London townhouse of the Duke of Wellington. This is a weird thing to think about. You can go and see it there. It includes a nude statue of Napoleon in the guise of the guard Mars. Let's conjure that for a second. Wellington said, this is exactly what I need to polish off my victory. A statue by Antonio Canova of Napoleon nude in the guise of the god Mars. And another point, a great deal of this confiscated and expropriated art made its way onto the art market, which flourished as never before during and especially after the Napoleonic Wars, which were, after all, the closest thing to a world war humanity had ever seen. And what we see here, I guess, is a moment of unprecedented imperialist appropriation of art and equally imperialist restoration of it to the old ruling order. Ironically also, we see in this the beginnings, the very beginnings, of the development of a body of international law that seeks to try to control and manage these things. So the body of international law that now under the United Nations oversees claims made by countries like Greece and Italy to have looted and art that belongs in their country but is in places like the Getty Museum Return, the beginnings of that kind of legal discourse actually also come out of this whole period of the Napoleonic era. Modern capitalist society came into existence through revolution and war, and involved massive transfers and accumulation of art in the form of cultural capital. Enlightenment theories of the autonomy of art, and I'm thinking here particularly most influentially of the German philosopher Kant's Critique of Judgment, which was published in 1790, the year after the fall of the Bastille. That kind of theory of the autonomy of art, of the separation of aesthetic value from practical interest and purpose, and of judgments of taste from historical change and political conflict, looked pretty limited and pretty self-serving in relation to the realities of cultural power and possession that we've been talking about. We still live in a world shaped by that ideology, by the way, and by the forces of cultural imperialism unleashed two centuries ago. Politicians still make pious pronouncements about the threats posed by political violence to humanity's artistic heritage, even as they support genocidal war in the Middle East, and even as they and solicit campaign donations from oil corporations that are, as it happens, very fond of high-end art investment and sponsorship of major exhibitions. BP is a major sponsor of art exhibitions at the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and to an even greater degree at London museums, the British Museum, the National Portrait Gallery, the Tate Gallery. ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil co-sponsored with Saudi Arabia a major exhibition called Roads of Arabia, Archaeology and History of Saudi Arabia. I wonder how they thought of that particular project to sponsor. And otherwise invest widely in art shows. The Arabian show opened at the Louvre in 2010. It was a serious exhibition, and then moved quickly to Houston, where it had a big following, before going on to New York. So on my way to winding up, I want to go back to literature and revolution and think a bit about Trotsky again. Trotsky doesn't directly discuss the kind of international art market or imperialist investments in cultural capital that I've been trying to get into. His main concerns are these. There are four of them. The emergence of a new revolutionary art culture in Russia during and after the revolution. Opposition, strong opposition, to the idea that the Soviet state should only support something called proletarian art. For Trotsky, it's much too soon in the early 1920s to know what kind of revolutionary culture the Russian working class will create. That's still to be seen. It's a process just in its beginnings. Three, advocacy for working class access to the entire history of art, including bourgeois art. I mean, for Trotsky, the idea that a working class that had by and large been illiterate, because beginning to learn to read for the first time, should be excluded from reading Shakespeare or Dante or Goethe or whatever was an insanity.
Right.
And then four, advocacy for complete freedom in artistic access and production, drawing the line only at cases where artistic freedom is exploited and abused by those seeking to attack and destroy the revolution itself. But though those are Trotsky's main emphases, his arguments unfold within a perspective that is completely opposed to imperialist nationalism, that understands the work of Dante and Shakespeare and Goethe, as well as of Pushkin, Turgenev, and Tolstoy, as the common property and resources of all humanity. I'll end by saying something about the Hermitage Museum in Leningrad in St. Petersburg, without any doubt one of the world's most important collections of art. The Hermitage was established in 1764 as the private collection of Catherine the Great, whose formal title was, in case you haven't heard this before, Tsarina and Autocrat of all the Russias. That's Catherine the Great. So she bought herself an art collection in 1764, paid a vast sum for about 300 paintings, it's debated its exact number, that had originally been a symbol for Frederick II of Prussia. Frederick took a look at the price and said, I don't think so, not now. So Catherine said, I've got it together, to just send them to St. Petersburg, I'll be glad to have them. That's the beginning of the collection of the Heritage. Not a bad collection. It included 13 Rembrandts, 11 Rubenses, 2 Raphaels, 2 Holbeins, and a Titian. And these paintings were installed in the Winter Palace. Got that? The Winter Palace. The place that would be stormed by the Bolsheviks and their followers on October the 25th, 1917. Now listen just for a second to this passage about what happened inside the Winter Palace with respect to things like art. This is from John Reed's 10 Days That Shook the World. Some of you may be familiar. Carried along by the eager wave of men, we were swept into the right-hand entrance, opening into a great bare vaulted room, the cellar of the east wing, from which issued a maze of corridors and staircases. A number of huge packing cases stood about, and upon these, the Red Guards and soldiers fell furiously, battering them open with butts of their rifles and pulling out carpets, curtains, linen, porcelain plates, glassware. One man went strutting around with a bronze clock perched on his shoulder. Another found a plume of ostrich feathers, which he had stuck in his hat. The looting was just beginning when somebody cried, "Comrades, don't touch anything. Don't take anything. This is the property of the people." Immediately, 20 voices were crying, "Stop. Put everything back. Don't take anything. Property of the people." Many hands dragged the spoilers down. Damask and tapestry were snatched from the arms of those who had them. Two men took away the bronze clock. Roughly and hastily, the things were crammed back in their cases, and self-appointed sentinels stood guard. It was all utterly spontaneous. Through corridors and up staircases, the cry could be heard growing fainter and fainter in the distance, "Revolutionary discipline, property of the people." We crossed back over to the left entrance in the west wing. There, order was being established. "Clear the palace," bawled a red guard, sticking his head around through an inner door. "Come, comrades, let's show them we're not thieves and bandits. Everybody out of the palace except the commissars until we get sentries posted." Two red guards, a soldier and an officer, stood with revolvers in their hands. Another soldier sat at a table behind them with pen and paper. Shouts of all out were heard far and near within, and the army began to pour through the door, jostling, expostulating, arguing. As each man appeared, he was seized by the self-appointed committee who went through his pockets and looked under his coat. Everything that was plainly not his property was taken away. The man at the table noted it on his paper, and it was carried into a little room. The most amazing assortment of objects were thus confiscated. Statuettes, bottles of ink, bedspreads worked with the imperial monogram, candles, a small oil painting, desk blotters, gold-handled swords, cakes of soap, clothes of every description, blankets. I mean, the mixture of objects, I think, is they're obviously not in the main place where the Rembrandts and Rubenses were, but they're, you know, the idea of this happening kind of in the basement below, where this mixture of things is really fascinating, I think. So what became of this moment, this spontaneous response to what was happening inside the Winter Palace, is that most of the really valuable artworks and antiquities in the Hermitage were soon sent to Moscow for safekeeping. At the end of 1820, beginning of 1821, after the Civil War was finally over, they were brought back at a period when the Hermitage had been declared a state public museum, and were returned to the Winter Palace and to other Hermitage buildings, and were open to everyone. Anyone who wanted to go could go in and see them, and you could look at the monogrammed bedspread, I suppose, but you could also look at the Titian or the Raphael, wherever your interest carried you. Also, a new museum of the October Revolution was established in the Winter Palace, right alongside the Tsar's art collection. Now, for me, this was and is revolutionary socialism's alternative to the artistic world of art accumulated by oppression and empire. It was and still is, I think, one of the most inspiring examples we have of the working class spontaneously organizing itself to lay claim on its own terms, both to the history of culture and to its own artistic future.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.